Good morning. Welcome to Hour 2 of Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for this program. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour. Kyle Mabry was on for Hour number 1. In this Hour of Focus, my guest is Lisa Randall. She studies theoretical particle physics and cosmology at Harvard University, and we'll be talking about some of what you'll find in her recent book. The title is Knocking on Heaven's Door, the subtitle, How Physics and Scientific Thinking Illuminate the Universe and the Modern World. And she says that she's trying to do a couple of things with this book. First of all, it is a book about the Large Hadron Collider. This is a machine that's been in the news, at least back last fall, about the machine and what we might learn from experiments being done there. But she also says it's a book that is about the nature of science, and she says that she thinks it's important for people to start thinking more scientifically and to understand scientists and what they do, and particularly the role of creativity in what scientists do. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. All we need to ask you to do is to be brief, if that's possible, but certainly you're welcome to join the conversation. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that's 800-222-9455. And also we can take emails as well. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. And at any point here, if you are interested in joining in the conversation, you can do that. And Professor Randall, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. What I would think people would take away from the title, aside from the fact that you might be a Bob Dylan fan, is that you think that we are really on the threshold of making some very important discoveries and getting greater insight into the way the universe is put together?
Well, I certainly hope so. And it sort of also is just more generally about how science advances, you know, building on existing knowledge to move forward and add new discoveries, and how one theory evolves into another and as you get more precise information. And it certainly is also a very exciting time now, and we're hoping to see new results within the next few years.
Yeah. I think here maybe we could talk a little bit about science and what scientists do, because it's very clear, as you say, this is something you'd like people to understand, and maybe you feel that they don't. And I think that, you know, what people, I think, find it confusing that the scientific community might have a consistent explanation for something, and that might go along for a number of years until the day comes when they say, well, you know, we've got new data, we've thought about this some more, and we think that actually we had it wrong, and this is what we think now. And on the one hand, I think some people would say, well, that's actually the strength of the scientific method, but I don't think people see it that way. They see it as scientists not being able to make up their minds. Or how would you like people to, what would you like people to know about, really, about what the essence of science is?
Well, basically, I was with you until you got to the point where you said we were wrong. Because generally speaking, at least in physics, the kind of physics I do, we're right in the sense that we've tested ideas. I do theory, but experiments have tested ideas and shown consistency.
Yeah.
What happens when more precise measurements are made is it's recognized that whatever you had before could be just an approximation.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, that's how all of our understanding works. We have the information that we're aware of if we try to find consistent theories to describe that. But underlying that can be more precise information. I mean, Newton's laws aren't wrong. They still work, but they are not the most fundamental description, as you know. Relativity or atomic physics, or quantum physics, rather, can take over. But it doesn't make Newton's laws wrong in the sense that they still make very accurate predictions. It's just not always as accurate as you need once you have more precise measurements.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what's happening. We're really building on old ideas, seeing how they might be only an approximation once we have more precise information, or once we've probed different regimes of energy or distance, for example.
Well, I wonder, do you think that because I do, and you know, again, maybe my perception is wrong, that there are other cases where people in different disciplines have indeed said, well, we were mistaken, or that we had something that just wasn't right. Do you think that somehow physics is different in that when new information comes along, what it results is a sharpening, perhaps, of what it is we know, not so much a rejection of what it is we had thought previously?
The difference, I think, is that it's a mature science
uh-huh.
in the sense that it's been around for a long time. The data that we get is really incremental in the sense that we've had a lot of data and we're building on it. And also, we've been lucky in a sense that one theory is an approximation to another. I mean, I think now we're seeing medicine or biological sciences where we really don't even know what the starting point is. And so there, you really can turn out to be wrong. It's not as advanced. And so in the beginning, you might just have the wrong interpretation. It's after you have some solid theory that's been well tested that you can then go on and try to refine it.
Let me ask you about something else that seems to be something you're interested in getting across, and that is the role of uncertainty in science. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that when a scientific measurement is presented, you never know it precisely. In fact, there's very little knowledge you ever know precisely. It's just we're pretty open about it in science.
Mm-hmm.
And part of presenting a measurement is to say, I've measured this number, but I only know it with this degree of accuracy or precision. What's interesting about that is it says that you have measured it. You can know a number incredibly well, but it leaves room for new information to come. That is to say, within that realm of uncertainty, there could be new predictions, new things that are happening that you just haven't had the precision yet to measure. So it's doing two things for you. It's just telling you that you only know your parameters so well, but it's also telling you how much room you have for this kind of advance that we've just talked about, for one scientific theory to build onto another.
Hmm. So also, then tell me about the role of creativity in what scientists do.
Well, creativity plays a big role. You know, there's many, many different kinds of scientists. It's not just one kind of scientist. So there will be some who are doing calculations for a known problem. But a lot of the time, you need sort of insights that come from different directions. And that might be, I think a lot of it is synthesizing different ideas at the same time, sort of holding all these different ideas in your head and putting them together to see something new. A lot of the time, it is really a genuinely new way of looking at something that helps you advance, even if it's just for a calculation. It might not be a big major advance in theory, but there is a lot of creativity going into finding new ideas and also finding new results.
Hmm. So I just, forgive me if this is sort of a boneheaded kind of question, but and we will, I'm sure, talk about the Large Hadron Collider and what devices like that will enable you to do. But having said all that, as a theoretical physicist, could you do a lot of what you do simply if, you know, you had paper and pen and a quiet place to sit down and
sure.
think?
Sure, and often I do that. It's one of the things I like. I'm pretty mobile in terms of what I do. I mean, we do talk to each other. It's nice to have people around to discuss with. But yes, in terms of thinking about ideas, working out calculations, you can do it anywhere.
Mm. And then though, the thing is that you have to come up with some experiments to test your ideas, and that's where you come into things like the collider.
Well, I mean, it's sort of an ongoing process. I mean, we have ideas we try to explain. Phenomena that are not yet explained by what's called the standard model of particle physics, which mm-hmm. describes objects like quarks and electrons and the forces through which they interact. It's supposed to be the most basic understanding that we have at the moment, and there are puzzles. So you might start off at a very theoretical level just trying to solve the puzzles, but if they are puzzles about the particular question that we expect to be addressed at the Large Hadron Collider having to do with particles getting their masses, in that case, we do expect there to be testable predictions. And yes, when we have a theory, we like to figure out what those predictions might be.
Hmm. We have a couple of callers here. We'll start bringing people into the conversation. For anybody who has just joined us, let me again introduce our guest, Lisa Randall. She studies theoretical particle physics and cosmology at Harvard University, and she is the author of the book Knocking on Heaven's Door, the subtitle How Physics and Scientific Thinking Illuminate the Universe and the Modern World. And this is HarperCollins imprint.
Echo Press,
which is HarperCollins. And so you can find the book. It's out there if you would like to read it. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a couple of callers here. We'll start over in Belgium. Line number four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both. I want to start the discussion here, maybe in a little bit of a concept. There was a physicist back at the turn of the last century, 1900s. His name was Heisman. And I'm sure you know Mr. Heisman, Dr. Heisman, I'm sure it is. And his theory was that any observation you make changes the thing that you're observing. Now, this works well from politics to local news to physics, which I think is an amazing theory of what he came up with. But how do you know, when you look at the things you look at, that they are actually what they are?
So first of all, the physicist is Heisenberg.
Yes, that's his name.
Second of all, that's really a very loose interpretation of what he said. It's not what he's saying. It's a very precise statement that he makes about how well you can measure both position and momentum. Mm-hmm. And then one can interpret that in terms of what it means for an experiment. This was always known. When you do an experiment, you have to know what it is you're doing. You're not necessarily, you are probing something, so in a sense you are interacting with it. But part of doing a good experiment is understanding what that interaction is and understanding what the implications are for the object that you have there. The fact that you're interacting with it doesn't mean that you can't measure things. I mean, his statement is more a statement that for most measurements it's not relevant, but of course once you get to a very fine degree of precision, it is relevant that you can't have an arbitrarily precise position of momentum. You can't pin down something with infinite precision. Most of the time, experimental uncertainties way exceed the values that you would have to worry about that. But it is something that's relevant. But I think it's, in the popular mind, it's an idea that people really like, and so they overstate it grossly. The fact is, when you do an experiment, part of the art is to try to get yourself out of it as much as possible, to try to see what's objectively there, independent of how you go about making that measurement. One way you might do that is to do the measurement in different ways, and another way is to really understand what it is that you're doing when you make a measurement.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll go over to somebody in Indiana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Two things. One more social and political, perhaps, is can you give a brief description or conception of your feelings that we're borrowing experimental data from foreigners, so to speak, with the Hadron over in Switzerland and France, and why the United States lost out in that. I vaguely remember something was supposed to be done in Texas but never got off the ground. Second question deals with things that people bring up to me all the time. I was a major in philosophy of science one time. Well, that's just theory. And I said, what are you talking about? I said, well, the theory of gravity doesn't mean it's real. It's just a theory. I wonder if you could speak to that and how you would handle
it. Okay, so first of all, the question of American physics. I think it's a very important question, and certainly in Illinois it's something you should be concerned with, because Fermilab used to have the highest energy accelerator. It was known as the Tevatron, and it just shut down. I mean, they have another ongoing program. But in terms of the highest energy accelerator, you're absolutely right. It's now in Europe. It's the Large Hadron Collider located at an institution called CERN near Geneva. And in fact, there was what would have been a much better, higher energy machine that was planned in Texas. They actually started to build it. And the joke is that it didn't get under the ground because it's a big tunnel that they did start to build. But then they cut it off, and it was really political considerations that entered into it. It was cost and political considerations. The fact is, you know, these experiments and these machines, these accelerators, they're a big investment. They take a long time, and we have to be committed to it. I mean, I think in the end, what we get out of them is incredibly worthwhile. We learn new things about the fundamental structure of matter, but it's something that we as a nation have to believe in and commit to, because it takes 10 years at least to build it. The Large Hadron Collider has been in the works for a quarter of a century. I mean, these are long projects that you really have to be devoted to. We're not really, just to correct, we're not really borrowing the data from Europe in the sense that scientific data is available to everyone, and in fact, there are more American experimenters than any other single nationality. We didn't build the machine, but Americans do play a big role on the experiments that are over there. And so a lot of the data will be analyzed by American physicists or physicists at American universities. But I agree with you that we should be thinking harder about where we want to go as a country in terms of what kind of physics we'd like to do. In terms of your second question about it's just a theory, I mean, that has a lot to do with just semantics. The fact is that people use scientific words very differently than we do in colloquial speech. And so when people say it's just a theory, they might mean I have no idea But for a scientist, as you know, we have a very definite idea what a theory is. And the reason we know that is we make predictions and they're successful and they're very accurate. And we make many different predictions and ideas can be tested in many different ways.
Hmm.
So I think it's one of the things I really do try to emphasize in my book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, is that I think a lot of the time scientists, when they write these books, they try to present it as sort of awe and wonder. And, of course, it is amazing stuff, but part of what I want to get across, especially in light of the current atmosphere, is that it's not just stuff we make up because it's beautiful. It's stuff that, you know, it's ideas that get synthesized and put together and tested.
Just real quick to go back to the other question, if it is the case that scientists from all over get to use the machine, and I'm sure that you can conduct experiments on it, that you could conduct experiments.
I'm a theorist.
Oh, okay. Well, say, let me put that one could conduct experiments. You know, one could be at Harvard, and you could conduct experiments on the LHC, and you wouldn't even have to go there. So does it really matter where the machine is?
Well, in fact, to run experiments, somebody has to be there. And people who are members of the experimental collaboration are expected to spend time there.
Yeah.
Obviously, for professors who are teaching, it could be hard, but graduate students and postdocs will spend a lot of time there, and they will, and even professors will try to get enough time over there. There's different phases of experiments. One is actually building the machinery, the experiment itself. Some can be built back at your institution, but it has to be installed there, and of course, a lot of it will get constructed there.
Mm.
You know, the wires will be attached there because that's where it's attached. But when you actually run the experiment, some people have to be there on shifts to make sure everything is running okay, to watch what's going on. After the data is recorded, then it can be analyzed, and you can do that analysis anywhere. Once it's on a computer, the computer data can be spread everywhere, and the analysis can take place in many different places, and in fact, it does.
Yeah.
But there is a real concentration of physics and experimenters there. I was just at CERN recently in January, and it really is different being there, being able to just talk to the experimenters who are interested right away.
Other calls. Next, we'll talk with someone in Effingham. This is line 4. Hello.
Yes. Some time ago, I discovered or read the German philosopher Schopenhauer. And part of his assessment was, try as we may, that there is no way to originate, to actually put the hands on about matter and motion. Thank you.
I don't know what that question means. I mean, we have matter. We can study matter. Standard model is understanding fundamental ingredients. It might not be the most fundamental, but we certainly get a better approximation. And we do understand motion. We have laws that describe dynamics. Again, there's a difference between philosophy, which might be asking about the ultimate precision beyond which we can get to, and physics, which is really very practical. We say, what can we measure and what can we predict about it, and what theory best describes what we see.
All right. Well, let's go to line number 2. This is Champagne. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Line 2.
Yes.
The nomenclature of, I guess, physics and astronomy have me puzzled a little bit because I've been trying to understand the potential of dark matter and dark energy. And I know the term dark there is implied that we don't know anything about it, so it's hidden, so to speak. And now, when we get to...
Can I just correct you for a minute?
Okay.
The word dark is really supposed to refer to the fact that it doesn't interact with light. I mean, we know something about it because we've measured its existence through its gravitational influence. And
okay.
In fact, dark is a bad terminology. It should be transparent because that's what...
Should
you know,
be transparent.
Dark things.
Okay.
Things.
Now, that brings me then to the next part of this, trying to understand the nomenclature, is in terms of the black hole in astronomy. We use that term in the sense that a light does not...
light is absorbed, yes.
Come out. And the implication of using the term hole means that it's, you know, a vacuum kind of thing or towards a vacuum, as opposed to if it were called a black mass, then the mass, the volume of energy that's there is what's keeping the light from emitting back. So I guess these terms like dark energy and dark matter and black holes are a little bit confusing for the layperson, and you've helped a little bit. Could you give me now just a very succinct statement about why black holes are called black holes?
Well, first of all, I didn't invent the term, so I can't tell you why it was called that. I think it was in part because there's something called a singularity at the center. When you solve the equations of general relativity, the equations of gravity, you find a place where things blow up. I don't know if that's the reason. I think it was just considered a colorful terminology. But I just want to say one thing, though, which is that when we as scientists use words, we really think about their scientific meaning. It is true. It's confusing when you talk at first. But it's funny. I almost forget the origin of the words in terms of what it means in terms of our ordinary language. It's something that I'm sort of more aware of when I hear the words in a foreign language. Like we do something called field theory, which is where we combine together quantum mechanics and relativity to study the physics of elementary particles. But in French, it's théorie des champs. And when I think of a champ, I think of a cow in a field chewing some grass. When I think of field theory in English, I don't think of it that way. I really don't think of the meaning of the word. I think of the scientific meaning. And I think that's basically what happens is you get used to the fact that words have different meanings and you get used to the scientific implications. But having said that, I do agree that one should choose words carefully so that you don't start off with confusing notions.
Okay, thank you very
much. All right, thanks. And just to bring this back to what it is you deal with in the book, it is apparently the thinking that it is possible that one of the things that might be learned with the use of the collider, the Large Hadron Collider, is something more about what dark matter and dark energy are.
Well, probably not dark energy. There is a chance we will, in fact, learn about dark matter in the Large Hadron Collider, because it just happens to have the right mass to be studied there.
All right. Other questions are welcome. We'll continue. We'll go to, again, someone in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes. Unfortunately, I haven't read your book yet, but it sounds extremely interesting. One thing that caught my eye was this: your concern with issues of cosmology. And one thing that frustrates me, I'm a scholar of religion at the university, and students and the general public more generally often have trouble understanding that the scientific method investigates only physical properties. In other words, it doesn't investigate the metaphysical. And so when you study cosmology, obviously you're only interested in the physical. Therefore, in a very real sense, you cannot knock on heaven's door, right? In fact, what science does doesn't try to investigate heaven or heaven's door in the metaphysical sense, as some people would interpret it from heaven. You know, this is, I just was hoping you would talk a bit about this because in the lay public, with regard to evolution and various other problems, they assume, of course, that, you know, science by implication is somehow, in conflict with religion. But when, of course, science can't establish and will not try to establish whether there's a creator, for example. And this is fundamentally based on a misunderstanding of what the scientific method tries to do.
Well, I have a couple of chapters on science and religion because I think there are misunderstandings, but I do also think there can be conflicts. I mean, I think but one of the reasons I wrote those chapters was because I wanted to get at where the conflicts truly arise, because I think, as you said, they're not always stated properly or clearly in the goals of science. And religion can be quite different. For example, religion can be a purely social and psychological phenomena, just for people to feel better about the world or to feel...
Right.
In terms of questions of origin, I think both science and religion don't have a way to really establish that. Because, as I said, our measurements only go back so far. We can only do it with a certain degree of precision. But where I do think that we really do have to be careful is when religion says there is an external influence that influences us today in our world somehow, either because it affects the motion of the planets today or because it affects my moral choice. Because as a scientist, even if I want to say that that's not a scientific issue, at some level there is a physical process that is, in fact, happening. And that is what we as scientists believe. We believe that even if we don't yet fully understand how it works, we do believe that those decisions that you make are rooted in the operations of your brain, which are rooted in electrical impulses and cellular structure, that one could ultimately study at a fundamental level. How that turns into the decisions you make is, of course, a very difficult question. But if one is to say that there are external supernatural influences of any sort, one would have to get down to that level and say that you believe that's happening at the level of, say, an individual neuron, which I think is a lot harder to comprehend. So when I wrote those chapters, I spoke to a lot of people, both spiritual and not. And people really do get stuck at that. They don't think about what it really means to say that it's influencing you somehow or influencing your life. And I do think that when you try to, because a lot of the things that you might think of as metaphysical actually do have physical origins, and you still have to take into account the fact that there is some physical reality underlying a lot of things.
Certainly the basis for knowledge is different, and one would have to reorient one's understanding, depending on, of course, the religion, the particular basis for knowledge.
Well, knowledge means something very different, actually.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. So we wouldn't actually call that knowledge necessarily. We would call it speculation or faith.
Right, right, right. Yeah, certainly, the basis for, interpreting phenomena and so forth would be very different depending on the particular faith.
Well, it's interpreting it according to how we as humans see it. And as I said, science tries to look at the objective reality. It's trying to detach it from how any individual sees something.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We're talking in this hour of Focus with physicist Lisa Randall. We are talking about some of the things that you will find in her recent book, Knocking on Heaven's Door. We will talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, the science of yoga. We talk with New York Times science reporter William Broad about his new book, which investigates the risks and rewards of yoga. Using the latest scientific research, Broad explains the benefits of yoga while debunking the myths surrounding it and explaining why certain yoga poses can be quite dangerous. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of advertising items, name badges, plaques, and trophies. They can also design and create unique awards for any occasion. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. More information is available at 351-7958.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. 10 different topics for you every week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we will do our monthly program on nutrition. And our guest there will be Karen Chapman Novikovsky. She's professor of nutrition at University of Illinois. And so we'll have questions on that, or you can ask questions on that. Then the second part of the program tomorrow, we will talk about the heart, the human heart. And our guests there will be the authors of a recent book. The title is The Sublime Engine, a biography of the human heart, and they are novelist Stephen Amidon and Thomas Amidon. He is a cardiologist. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have different topics every day. We try to include a lot of different sorts of things, and if you'd like to see what we'll be doing in the days ahead or listen to past programs, you can go to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. And the guest in this part of Focus is Lisa Randall. She studies theoretical particle physics and cosmology at Harvard University. She is the author of the recent book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, How Physics and Scientific Thinking Illuminate the Universe and the Modern World. Echo is the publisher. It's a division of HarperCollins. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just before we try to get back here to physics, I'm just curious if you can talk a little bit about how it is that you became a physicist or that you got interested in physics.
Actually, I liked math. I liked solving problems. And I wanted to do something that had to do with the world. I'm not sure I was actually positive I would do it, but I thought perhaps arrogantly I could switch into other things, but if I was going to do physics, I really should start with it and see how I liked it. And I liked the kind of particular problems that particle physics in particular poses, the flexibility, and especially doing theory, that I can work on different problems in both particle physics and cosmology. It's really nice. I have that flexibility.
Well, that's I think one of the things that maybe it's interesting about this, about physics, is that there are people who study the biggest things there are and people who study the smallest things there are, and that you're actually, I think, interested in both of those things, the biggest things and the smallest things.
Yeah, I like the extremes, which is where knowledge is advancing. And try, but in the end of the day, of course, we have one world and one universe, and it should all fit together.
Well, then, see, that gets to the question. I guess it's my understanding that what physicists are interested in, whether you're talking about the biggest things or the smallest things, is that you would like to have a set of rules that would explain how things work at both levels, the biggest things and the smallest things. And I guess the question is, do we have, or are we actually close to a set of rules that would do that?
Well, the smallest things that we've measured, I mean, we have a speculation, we're 16 orders of magnitude away from what is probably the smallest thing. Right now, the Large Hadron Collider is exploring the smallest scales that we've had experimental access to, mm-hmm. which in scientific notation is 10 to minus 19th meters. So it's really very small, but one can imagine even much smaller scales. And so we don't have the final answers, and we're trying to advance step by step. In terms of the largest scales, we really talk about the scales that we can observe, because the speed of light is finite, and the universe has existed a finite amount of time. But then there could be an infinite universe that surrounds it. And so there's a range of scales that we can deal with, both with theory and hopefully with observations or experiments. And then there are regimes beyond that where we can speculate and try to make consistent theoretical interpretations of what's going on.
Well, what essentially is it that we're still, you know, maybe there are a lot of things that we're still trying to learn, but if you would... As a sort of a simple way of asking this question, well, what is it yet we don't really know about the mechanics of things on the very elemental level? What would that be?
Well, the questions the Large Hadron Collider are trying to address primarily have to do with how particles acquire their masses. That might sound strange, but it turns out elementary particles cannot have masses from the get-go, according to our theories. You would make nonsensical predictions. So part of it has to do with something you might have heard of called the Higgs mechanism and its experimental consequence, which is the Higgs boson. But it even goes beyond that to try to say, what is it that lies beyond and explains why those masses are what they are? And that might lead to very, very compelling and different types of theories, even about the nature of space or the symmetries of space-time. And that could be very interesting.
And well, it did, in fact, have an email. I was hoping that we would get to this point. I did, in fact, even have an email from somebody who was interested in having you talk about the Higgs boson. And this was in the news maybe a few months back. There was some thinking that maybe it might have been found, or you were on the edge of finding it, and in fact this thing that we've talked about, the Large Hadron Collider, was thought to be the thing that if somebody was going to find it, this was the device they were going to use.
Right. And so I actually talk a lot about the Higgs boson. I have a whole chapter in my book about that, or about the Higgs mechanism and the Higgs boson. And at the time it came out, I actually wrote a couple of pieces for Science Times and for Newsweek. But basically... there's a lot of interesting physics happening at the Large Hadron Collider, but one of the things that we really do think will be this Higgs boson should be seen if it exists, in the way the simplest theories tell us it might, within the next year. There were hints. I mean, it's a very difficult measurement to do, and the mass happens to be in a particularly tricky range to find it. But there were hints of evidence that the Higgs boson could be there, and there's a definite energy range. We've now narrowed it down through the experiments. So if the Higgs boson exists, there's a very narrow window for it. And next year, we probably will find out whether or not it really is there in that window. If it's not found, it doesn't mean the Higgs mechanism that gives particles their masses is wrong, but it does mean it would be implemented by a more complicated, subtle theory, which people like me, theorists, will have to figure out what it is and make predictions about it. There are already speculations. If it is found, of course, that would just be the final ingredient to understand the standard model of particle physics.
So is this the thing that would then allow you to use the standard model to account for gravity?
No.
No.
We already use the standard model as well as we can. It would show us that the standard model is consistent, what underlies it. People get confused because we talk about masses, but mass is a property of a particle. And we think of it as how things respond to gravity, which is, of course, correct. But really, it also tells you how things travel through space. We actually neglect gravity a lot of the time when we're doing particle physics, because it's such an incredibly weak force. And to study gravity, we probably would really need a machine that was basically 16 orders of magnitude bigger, but really quite strong, high energy. So we're not there. Unless some of these ideas, such as the one about extra dimensions of space that I explore a little bit in this book and also in my previous book, Warp Passages, are right. Warp passages, if that turns out to be correct, then we do have a chance of learning about gravity. But without something that exotic, we probably won't learn about gravity at the Large Hadron Collider, but we could learn about the nature of space and time, which in some sense is learning about the nature of gravity.
All right. We have some other callers here. We're moving into about our last 15 minutes with our guest, a physicist, Lisa Randall, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll take some more calls here. Coles County is the next person in line on our line number 4. Right here. Hello.
Yes. It's the general consensus now that space is expanding. But there are several ways in which this could occur, and I'm not sure how it's conceived. For example, if we thought of space as being quantized, as the space expands, we could think of the quanta becoming larger, or alternatively, we could think of some source adding quanta, space quanta, to the universe. How is this generally conceived?
Well, don't forget that even if space itself is expanding, objects on small scales can be highly held together by various other forces, and so we don't necessarily have to worry about that. For example, when the universe expands, an atom isn't expanding. An atom is held together by forces that influence it much more. Or even a planet isn't expanding because there are gravitational forces holding it together. But space itself is. In terms of the sort of ultimate discretization of space, that's where this notion that we sort of alluded to in the beginning of how science builds on itself comes into play. On the scales we're looking at space, that we don't see that. That's much too small and fine-grained for us to observe anything like at this point. It's a perfectly valid approximation to say that space is continuous. What we don't know, it might turn out to break down at some scale, but if it does, it's very likely to be breaking down at a scale something like 16 orders of magnitude below what we can see or even hope to get information about. So, yes, I mean, these things can all be happening, but no, they don't affect the way we're doing science today.
Would this expansion then account for the redshift in the sense that the wavelength increases?
Yeah, so it does account for redshift, yes. So that's how the expansion of the universe was originally discovered.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thank you. On to back here local, Urbana, next, line number 1. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I was reading an article in the December issue of Harper's that was written by Alan Lightman, who teaches at MIT, and it was titled The Accidental Universe and subtitled Science's Crisis of Faith. Now, it was probably a little bit over my head, but the gist of it, as I understood it, was where he says the strength of the basic forces and certain other fundamental parameters in our universe appear to be fine-tuned to allow the existence of life. And then he goes on to say, the recognition of this fine-tuning led British physicist Brandon Carter to articulate what he called the anthropic principle, which states that the universe must have the parameters it does because we are here. We are here to observe it.
Yeah, so I do give a nod to...
Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, so I do get to actually talk about it again.
Yeah, well, my question was, I thought what it boiled down to was that you have to choose between believing in intelligent design or in the multiverse.
Well, that's why I actually think that it's a little premature to insist that we have the multiverse at this point.
Yeah.
You know, science is looking for explanations. It might be that there's some phenomena that really are explained by our particular existence, but I would like to see a deeper understanding of that. We don't know if the anthropic principle is, in fact, the explanation, although there are questions that are just very hard to find. the fact that there are tuned parameters, I mean, one has to be careful about that because, of course, we evolved into this particular existence. So one has to see what are the parameters that really had to be the way that they were and how likely that is at some level, but also is there another explanation? So I think a lot of people in the general public like this idea. I think there's more controversy in the scientific community.
So did you say that this choice, either or choice, is not really there?
I would not say that. I think there's also a possibility there can be explanations. And once you go beyond what we understand, then there's probably an infinite number of choices. But right now, there are things that we can explain and the things we can't yet understand.
I thought that is what the multiverse was all about.
An infinite number of
An infinite number of universes, then anything can happen, including this.
It's not quite as simple as that, but it is true that they try to imagine that there are universes where different possibilities get realized and that we end up living in one of them.
But
and that's certainly possible, but...
Is it a true statement, which I also read, that our universe seems to be balanced on a knife edge of improbability? And to get around that, you either have to assume this...
Yes and no, because it could be we don't understand that phenomenon yet.
Okay.
So it does seem like an odd value, but maybe one day we'll have a theory that explains it.
I want to thank the caller. I have a couple of others. I want to try to at least include one or two. Going next to, let me see, where
Can
am
you
I going?
I discuss this issue in my book.
All right, and you can go out and read Knocking on Heaven's Door, and you can read some more. Let's go to Piatone, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. I was wondering, with the way the economy is and the way all this scientific study is, everybody wants to study something. It seems to me we ought to step back a bit and see what is going to, you know, what we should or shouldn't study and how is it going to help mankind. Because right now, I mean, NASA, for instance, has got a wealth of information. Nobody seems to care about them because they're a government entity. Which is sad because we've kind of put aside a lot of good information and good projects that were supposed to be coming up because of lack of funding. And having, you know, because we're in the Midwest, it doesn't seem like it makes any sense anymore because nobody really cares about that aspect of it. I grew up in the Southwest, and there was a lot of development in science in general in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and in parts of the 90s, and now it seems like everything is kind of drying up scientifically, and it's going to other countries. It's to me, is there a way to get it back in America and grow this country with the science that can help us as humans in the long run? Because people are asking what they're getting for their dollar more and more, and I think if you could prove that it's going to help mankind in general, maybe they would, you know, be more likely to spend a little bit more out of their paycheck. Thank you. I'll get off.
Well, this was really the second theme in the book of sort of why scientific thinking is important and basically why science is important, but also what scientific thinking really involves. I think it's true that we as a nation should be more aware of that. It's often hard to do a very explicit dollar and cents calculation. It's hard to do a cost-benefit analysis on the value of science. But it is true that where we have had scientific advances, we've had a growing economy that's come along with it. So it is clear there is a connection. And in the case of the Large Hadron Collider, there are specific developments going on in magnets and in computing power. World Wide Web was developed at CERN. Quantum mechanics gave rise to semiconductor industry. And there are many amazing things that come out of fundamental science that can't be predicted. But also scientific thinking is important so we start making the right decisions about things. I think we see science almost made fun of sometimes sort of when discussed in the public. But just really, we have such difficult questions we're facing, such as those the economy that were mentioned. And so using the scientific method, of course, would be extremely helpful as input.
I have an email here, and I have another call. We'll try to do them both. The person who was writing in would like you to talk a little bit about the faster-than-light particles that have, or thought maybe that there are faster-than-light particles that may or may not have been discovered at CERN.
Yeah, so it's really the grand SASA. So what happened is they sent a particular type of particle called neutrinos from CERN many kilometers away to the Grand Sasso mine in Italy. And the claim is that the measurements seem to indicate they've arrived faster than would be allowed by the speed of light. The general consensus is that they made a mistake. They don't yet know where the mistake in their measurement is. This experiment was not designed to do that particular measurement. It was designed to measure the properties of these neutrinos. So we're waiting to find out what the answer is. They're doing experiments different ways. A Fermilab will also do an experiment. So, yes, this is out there. But also, even if it turned out to be right, I just want to come back to the original point we made. It wouldn't mean Einstein's theory is wrong. It would mean it was an approximation that breaks down at some level.
Okay. Another caller here, Spring Bay, line 3. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Huh? Aside from the space station going around, what is your opinion of the necessity of a continuation of putting humans in space versus just proceeding with probes, robots, scientific instruments, and that sort of thing? And I'll get off and listen to your comments.
Well, I have to be careful about that since I have some friends that are trying to put people into space. But I think from the point of view of science, really, just pure science and really investigating the universe, a lot of time we don't need to have humans in space, and it makes projects much more expensive and much more difficult to complete. Having probes, I mean, obviously, if you have a person, there are things they can do that you might not have been anticipated originally, but with robot technology being developed as it is, and we probably will get a lot more bang for the buck from non-human investigations, although there are people that just like the idea of sending people elsewhere.
We're coming down to the point. We have a couple of minutes, and I'm not sure I should launch into something so complex, but here I go. I think people maybe will think back to when they were first introduced to the idea of the atom, and it was explained to them that you know, whatever solid surface they would reach out and touch, if you tunnel down, what you're going to get to is this very, very small thing, which then in turn is made of some very small things. And people remember, okay, atom has a nucleus in the middle, and that's made of protons and neutrons, and then spinning around that we have electrons. Then, though, maybe if people went far enough, then they would next understand, well, in fact, those things aren't the smallest things. They're even smaller things that constitute those things, and that's when we get into things like quarks and some of the things that we've been talking about. So we have these fundamental particles, which have been this big zoo of them that has been identified. Is that the end of it? Does one tunnel down further, or is there some point?
Well, that's what we're trying to find out. I mean, my personal opinion is that would be very unlikely. It would be very coincidental if we just happen to live at the time where we have all the answers and we've gone to the deepest probe that you can get to. Very likely there is structure underlying what we see, and we haven't been able to see it yet. With the advances in technology, we can build on what we know.
And that's what things like the Large Hadron Collider are designed
exactly.
to do.
Exactly.
And now this, though, it's the highest energy accelerator that has yet been built to learn more. I mean, if you're gonna tunnel down deeper, find out about deeper structure, would you then have to build an even bigger one to do that?
According to the way we study things, either bigger or we would need stronger magnets. I mean, there is a hope to actually eventually install stronger magnets. I mean, the constraint is because essentially things radiate as they go around, and that's why you have these heavy objects, but then you have to keep them in a ring. So you have protons going around, but you have to keep them in a ring. And to keep them in a ring, and the reason you want them in a ring is so that they can be repeatedly accelerated through the same field. So in the case of the protons of the Large Hadron Collider, they're going around 11,000 times a second. But in order to keep them in this ring, you need magnets. And the smaller the ring is, the bigger strength the magnets would have to be to keep those protons in. As they have more energy, you need even stronger magnets. So you have a choice of building a bigger tunnel, a bigger ring, or stronger magnets. So the SSC would have been a bigger tunnel.
That was the one that they were talking about building in the superconducting supercollider that they were talking about building in Texas that we talked about a little bit earlier.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that could, or you can have stronger magnets, and that is something being at least considered with a Large Hadron Collider.
All right. Well, when at some point now, you think that this year or next year we're going to have some really important things coming out of?
Like I said, I think this year we will know about the Higgs boson. We won't know the answer to everything, but we will know the question about whether the Higgs boson exists, probably.
So what is it that you would really like to know?
Oh, I'd like to know the answer to all the questions we've been talking about.
You like everything. You would like to know everything.
Pretty much. I'd like to know the nature of space, the nature of gravity, the nature of mass. What is dark matter? What is dark energy? There's a lot of questions out there.
Yeah, and those things would, for those people who, I think you touched on this, but for those people who would say, well, knowing this for the sake of knowing it is swell, but that there are then, that will result in being able to manipulate matter in ways that perhaps we can't now?
Well, I don't know if that's true, and whenever we... Anyone doing fundamental physics has never been, I don't know examples where they've been able to correctly predict the implications, but having a smart, educated populace where people study science and try to get to the edge of knowledge, there's always good things that come out of it.
Hmm. Well, I guess we can leave it at that point with the suggestion that if people would like to read more, there certainly is more. And it is a book that it's you don't have to be a physicist to read this book. It is intended for a general audience. The title is Knocking on Heaven's Door, and the subtitle, How Physics and Scientific Thinking Illuminate the Universe and the Modern World. Echo is the publisher. That's a division of HarperCollins. And the author, our guest, Lisa Randall, she's professor of physics at Harvard University. And Dr. Randall, thank you very much.
Thank you.